B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, January 3rd, 2019. And it's official. The Democrats have taken control of the House of Representatives, providing a check on the power of the White House and the Republican-controlled Senate. And as expected, Nancy Pelosi was elected Speaker by the House. There were some Democratic defectors. We'll talk about that in a moment. But what I think is interesting is that this could be the pivot point. Because in an interview aired this morning, Nancy Pelosi said, well, you know, this idea that a sitting president can't be indicted? She said, well, that is an open question. I don't think that it is conclusive. No, I do not. I think that that is an open discussion. I think that is an open discussion in terms of the law. When asked about impeachment, well, we have to wait and see what happens with the Mueller report, she said. We shouldn't be impeaching for a political reason, and we shouldn't avoid impeachment for a political reason. So we'll just have to see how it comes. Now, that is certainly a rehearsed soundbite. But it does crack open the door. It's no longer impeachment is off the table in all cases. And my old buddy Brad Sherman, he and I don't agree on everything, particularly policy toward Israel, but he's a congressman from Sherman Oaks in Southern California, and he refiled his resolution to impeach Trump for obstruction of justice as the House opened for business today. So we'll see where it goes. As you know, I believe that the Democrats have a duty to investigate Trump, and I believe that he is impeachable, and I believe they should take those steps. Now, Pelosi had a great moment of grandeur as she resumed the speakership. She's one of the few people who has served as speaker in more than one House cycle. And, of course, she is still the first woman to serve as Speaker of the House. It makes her second in line for the presidency, right behind the vice president in the order of succession. And as is her wont, Nancy Pelosi surrounded herself by her five grandchildren and her five children and her 150 grandchildren. And she loves to sound the theme that her work is all about our children. So, as expected, there are many Democrats who had campaigned on a pledge not to support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker, and many of them held to that pledge. Anthony Brindisi of New York, Jason Crow of Colorado, Joe Cunningham, South Carolina, Ben McAdams of Utah, Max Rose of New York, Mikey Sherrill of New Jersey, Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, Jeff Drew of New Jersey, Jared Golden of Maine, and Jim Cooper of Tennessee, Ron Kind, Wisconsin, Connor Lamb, Pennsylvania, Kurt Schrader of Oregon, and Kathleen Price, Rice of New York. But, of course, she had engineered it. One of the things Pelosi is really good at is counting the votes and rounding up the number that she needs. And she did not fail, and that was not unexpected. Now, of course, the focus turns to Democrats who are announcing that they want to run for president in 2020, and Bernie Sanders, who many people believe has kind of a head start on the rest of a rather large field. Well, he's got to confront some problems here, because the New York Times has a big story today. Sexism claims from Sanders' 2016 run. Women were paid less and treated worse. Now, there are some anecdotes here that I will not sugarcoat. They are clear incidences that should have been dealt with. There is a young woman named Juliana DeLauro, a Latino outreach strategist from Nevada, and she was assigned to drive a campaign surrogate who was a Mexican guy. I don't know about this fellow. But anyway, he wanted to touch her hair, and he ran his fingers through her hair and pushed her boundaries. And you can understand that's an uncomfortable situation. It's not rape. It's not sexual assault, but it is concerning. And she says that when she reported the incident to a manager on the Latino outreach team, he joked about it. I bet you would have liked it if the guy was younger. And She claims that there was no further effort. The man in question says, well, he actually did make sure that that surrogate was never alone with an individual woman after that. Bernie Sanders issued an apology on CNN last night. I certainly apologize to any woman who felt she was not treated appropriately, and of course, if I run, we will do better the next time. Asked if he knew about these complaints, he didn't actually say no. He said, I was a little bit busy running around the country trying to make the case. And this woman is not alone. Samantha Davis, former director of operations in Texas and New York, said that her supervisor marginalized her after she declined an invitation to his hotel room. There are also claims of disparate pay. Women who learned that less qualified men were making far more than they. However, the Times reports that when complaints were made, there was a substantial effort to provide pay parity. So I don't dispute that there was bad behavior inside the Sanders campaign. I think it was pretty chaotic, not terribly well organized, and that these things do happen. By the way, the surrogate in Nevada is a Mexican game show host named Marco Antonio Regil. Never heard of the guy, and I can't imagine how he was supportive of Bernie in Nevada. But, you know, hey, that's apparently how it went down. So, a couple of days ago, in fact, I have to go back. This was first published on November 28th. It's an open letter to Bernie Sanders from scholars, activists, progressives, who support his domestic policies and acknowledge the impact, the inroads that he made in 2016. But they give him a lot of tough love, saying that he's got to speak up more on foreign policy. They write, during your presidential campaign, you were asked repeatedly how you would pay for human and environmental needs that could be paid for with small fractions of military spending. Your answer was consistently complicated and involved raising taxes. We believe it would be more effective to more often mention the existence of the military and its price tag. For example, I would cut 4% of spending on the never-audited Pentagon. That's a better answer than any kind of a tax plan. We believe this omission is not just a shortcoming. We believe it renders what does get included incoherent. Military spending is well over 60% of discretionary spending. A public policy that avoids mentioning this is not a public policy at all. So I think this is a well-targeted. It is deserved. Bernie Sanders has expanded his commentary on foreign policy issues. He has pushed for a vote on war powers to restrict the U.S. involvement in Yemen. He has spoken up about the Palestine-Israel conflict. But he's got a long way to go. And I agree with the 100 individuals who signed on to that letter. And I hope that Bernie will acknowledge it and will make changes appropriately. Also, Norman Solomon, who is one of the heads of the Bernie Delegates Network, along with Jeff Cohen, he posted on Facebook yesterday the results of a poll of those who were delegates for Bernie Sanders to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. And a total of 384 of them responded. 76% answered yes to the question, is Bernie Sanders your first choice for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination? 5% flatly said no. They are over the burn. And 19% are undecided. Now, I think this is interesting, and it does. It's just a subset, a small group of people, but they were the most committed people who went all the way to the convention knowing that Bernie was not going to be nominated. And so I think that that does reflect pretty strong support out of the gate for Sanders. And I don't spend a lot of time talking about polls here. I don't use them that much to inform my commentary. But I was struck by this Rasmussen poll that was emailed to me yesterday. And it's from a huge national sample, 10,000 likely voters. That makes it a pretty credible poll. Donald Trump, in December, earned a job approval of 48%. And it's just down 1 point from his high watermarks in April and October of 49%. Now, 51% disapproved of his job performance last month. That is a majority. But it's a narrow majority, and Trump has mastered minority rule. The Electoral College supports that, and I think people should know that while you and I can't stand this guy, can't believe that people still support him, his base is still very strong. That 48% is comprised of 34% of voters strongly approving of his job performance in December. That's including the pullout from Syria that's been announced and now walked back a little bit, the threat of a government shutdown that was carried out, the resignation of Secretary of Defense Mattis. His base doesn't give a shit. And tomorrow, I'll be releasing an in-depth interview with psychologist Bryant Welch, who is going to shed some light on that. I think you'll find that interesting. So the Trumpster called a cabinet meeting yesterday. He spent about 90 minutes with his team, which is half temporary, as I pointed out yesterday, who interrupted him only occasionally to kiss his ass. And Trump rambled on about all kinds of things, about walls, who's got a wall and why walls are good. The Vatican's got a wall. The Obama's got a wall. But, of course, he rambles and he gets off course and strays from the facts just a little bit. So, for example, he said, the United States needs a physical barrier. It needs a wall. Then he said he didn't care if the barrier's a wall, but he emphasizes that a wall is needed. He said it would stop the flow of heroin into the country. It would stop human trafficking. And then, of course, he lied. He said there are probably 30 to 35 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. The most reliable number is about 11 million. And they cost the government $250 billion, which is a number that he made up, because the highest number that comes from the most virulent anti-immigrant group is a phony number, but they claim that immigrants cost $116 billion a year. The truth is that they contribute a lot to the economy, they pay a lot of taxes, and they never get a tax refund because, well, many of them are working on somebody else's Social Security number. So the interruptions came occasionally. Kirstjen Nielsen, who was on a video link from the border, applauded his leadership on border security. Matt Whitaker, who didn't pull the plug on Mueller during the holidays, as I feared, he's the acting attorney general. He praised the president for giving up his Christmas and New Year's holidays while some members of Congress went on vacation. Crazy Rick Perry, the former Texas governor and energy secretary, praised the president. You're standing up and saying, don't come. And Mike Pence, of course, didn't want to be left out. He piled on. I want to thank you for the strong stand you've taken on border security. What a team. What a team of fine Americans making us great again. Now to the government shutdown and the battle over that wall. The Democrats are holding firm. They did not increase their number of $1.3 billion for border security in the meeting in the Situation Room at the White House yesterday. And when you look back at what occurred there and the commentary that the Democrats made after the meeting, it strikes me that the Democrats believe that the best way to proceed is to concede to Trump, yes, we need border security. Yes, we're all for border security, just not the wall. And they're making this kind of technical argument. And they are missing the bigger boat. And that is, they fail to criticize Trump for the lies that he told about the caravan, for the false alarm of sending U.S. troops to the border for nothing, the false claims that this is a national security issue and that we're under siege. And they don't even note that he is a serial hostage taker. And now he's taken 800,000 government workers hostage by shutting down parts of the government over his demand for funding for his wall. And I don't know if you see the same thing. I don't object to the kind of triangulation where Democrats want to say they don't want to create this image that they are against border security. I understand that vulnerability. But to fail to take on with some moral outrage, the outrageous behavior of this president and his outrageous policies, I think is a huge missed opportunity and just a fundamental mistake. And if they were in these meetings or when they leave the meetings, we're saying, look, you know, the president doesn't have to lie about this. Put it on the record that he fabricates all kinds of stuff. And I think that it's one of the reasons why he feels encouraged that he can continue this shutdown and force the Democrats to cough up money for his wall. Yesterday, late in the day, I released an in-depth interview. It's the audio from a recent local television interview I did with Frank Egger and Steve Volker. Frank Egger is a longtime environmental activist and president of the North Coast Rivers Alliance. And Stephen Volker is an environmental attorney with a great record. He started out working for the Sierra Club, and he's been in private practice for about 20 years now. Here's an excerpt from that conversation as attorney Steve Volker explains how they got the judge to issue the injunction that is holding up and currently blocking construction of the Keystone XL pipeline.
But the turning point in the case actually arose out of a case we did on the other border between America and Mexico, where we likewise represented a small local group of environmental leaders who were opposed to a major energy project that crossed the border there. And the reason this is important is that historically, the president has claimed to have authority to ignore federal environmental law when issuing presidential permits, which are required to cross those two borders. And in the case we did in Southern California, also in federal district court in 2015, the court ruled for us in a precedent-setting order declaring that the president was not above the law, that he was subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and other federal environmental laws when issuing presidential permits. You see, the president is not a federal agency. And so the Department of Justice for decades has argued it's not subject to these environmental laws. And armed with that precedent, in that case, we were able to persuade Judge Brian Morris in Great Falls that President Trump likewise was not above the law in this case.
I encourage you to listen to the full interview. It's about half an hour. There's also a link to the video in the show file for that podcast if you would like to check it out. And it's a fascinating story. The lawsuit that they filed against the Keystone XL pipeline preceded all of the protest activity that was fostered by Bill McKibben and others from 350.org. And my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast is made possible by people like you, who support it with $5 or $10 a month. I get $5 a month from Lyle Rubin and Anna Gordonier and Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio. Robert Littweiler took advantage of the best deal, the $50 annual subscription, and he just renewed that. Thank you very much, Robert. I invite you to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. I don't use guilt or shame, but I would like you to understand that your support of my work puts a nickel or two in my pocket, and it validates the work that I'm doing here. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button. Click on it. Then pick Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and you can choose the $5, $10, $20, $50 level. And also, I know many of you are allergic to PayPal, with good reason. You can just drop a check or cash in the mail, Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. And I appreciate your support. Over at the EPA, we have an acting director, Andrew Wheeler, a former coal industry lobbyist. And it was announced a couple of days ago that they are changing their methodology and imposing a cost-benefit analysis for EPA rules. And it is leading Andrew Clean Coal Wheeler to change the regulations about mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants. And it gets into some technical lingo here about ignoring the co-benefits and that the cost-benefit analysis only relates to the most toxic elements that are spewed by these power plants. And it enables them to say, for example, that trying to limit the pollution of mercury is not cost effective. And, of course, the lives, the health impacts, those are not included. The only costs they talk about are the costs to industries for trying to prevent the toxic releases. Yesterday, I told you about Paul Whelan. He's a guy from the Detroit suburbs who is now in custody in Moscow, facing a prison sentence of as much as 20 years. And all I can say is the more we learn about this guy, the worse it looks. So first we heard just that he was an ex-Marine, that he is a corporate security guy who has been assigned to work in Russia for his company in the past. Well, but then we learned that he got a dishonorable discharge from the Marine Corps after a couple of tours in Iraq. He was court-martialed for larceny and passing bad checks. He has been traveling to Russia since at least 2006. He has a social media account in Russia on VKontakte, the Russian version of Facebook. He has many Russian friends there, and the curious thing is they seem to be more male than female. There are guys who go to Russia to chase girls, but he appears to prefer contacts with men, including some who have connections to the Russian Navy, the Defense Ministry, the Civil Aviation Authority. Well, some of these details are now being shared by the Russians, who said that Whelan was apprehended during a meeting with a Russian citizen in his room at the Metropole Hotel. Now, come on, Whelan. Don't you know that any hotel room in Moscow is probably bugged and has cameras? He's accused of trying to recruit this Russian citizen to obtain classified information about staff members at various Russian agencies. And he was arrested after receiving a memory stick, a USB stick, containing a list of all the employees at a classified security agency. Now, he may have been entrapped, but he also may have been some sort of a freelance spy. What is interesting is that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has made kind of neutral comments, saying that they want to hear more from the Russians about what he did, but they are not turning this into some sort of an international crisis. We'll continue to follow. I'm not shocked, but the Florida Commission of 15 citizens, impaneled to look at what caused the massacre at Parkland, Florida's high school last year, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, they have issued a 446-page report, which includes a recommendation that teachers be trained and permitted to carry guns on school campuses. They also recommended hardening the campuses with locks on the inside of classroom doors, funding to install bulletproof glass on all school windows. But the idea that arming teachers is going to make students and schools safer is really a canard. Juliana Simone Carrasco, a student and volunteer with Students Demand Action: as a student attending school in Florida, I am appalled that the commission that was established to make schools in our state safer is recommending that teachers carry guns. And Gay Valamont, a volunteer with the Florida chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense: there is no evidence that arming teachers makes kids safer. Now, in addition, the report is critical of the Broward County Sheriff's Office and its inconsistent policies related to what to do when there's an active shooter on campus. Over the holiday break, one of the most astounding articles that I read was published by the New York Magazine folks on December 26 under the byline of Max Reed. And the headline reads, "How much of the Internet is fake?" Turns out, a lot of it, actually. And Max Reed does a great breakdown here. He says 2018 was the year of the inversion, where there's more fake shit on the Internet than real. And he breaks it down. He says the metrics are fake. Facebook is unable to produce genuine figures. Small advertisers have filed suit against Facebook, accusing it of covering up for a year its significant overstatements of the time users spent watching videos on the platform. And Max Reed opens with a description of these places in the U.S. and abroad where they have hundreds of phones lined up that are logging time on Facebook and YouTube videos. What does that do? Well, it makes it look like more people are watching them, and it makes it more valuable to an advertiser to link an ad or insert an ad on that particular content. Well, the lawsuit against Facebook argues that the estimates of video time is overstated by 150 to 900%. And then Max Reed takes a look at how there are fake businesses, there's fake content, and there are real people who are being followed by bots. There are bots being followed by real people. And it's just a big soup. So I encourage you to read this piece, because I think we need to rethink our approach to the internet. We have to approach it with much greater skepticism. It's not just the Nigerian prince who wants to put money in your bank account. The whole thing is riddled with false pretenses and false content. Caitlin Johnstone is the amazing writer from Australia, and she has amazing sources here in the U.S. I have no idea how she got the resignation letter of NBC journalist William Arkin. He's been working at NBC on and off for about 30 years, and he is leaving again. He mentions that he's left there twice before. And he isn't angry, but he's honest, and he's critical. He said, "I have found myself often a lone voice that was anti-nuclear and anti-military. Anti-military for me, meaning opinionated, but also highly knowledgeable, like a movie critic, loving my subject, but not shy about making judgments regarding the flops and the losers." Then he was hired back to work in 2016 on an investigative team. Quote, "I thought the mission was to break through the machine of perpetual war acceptance and conventional wisdom to challenge Hillary Clinton's hawkishness. It was an interesting moment at NBC because everyone was looking over their shoulder at Vice News and other upstarts creeping up on the mainstream. Then Trump got elected and the investigations unit got sucked into the tweeting vortex, increasingly lost in a directionless adrenaline rush, the national security and political version of leading the broadcast with every snowstorm." And I would assert that in many ways, NBC just began emulating the national security state itself. No wars won, but the ball is kept in play. He makes other really strong comments. It's a book-length letter. I read the whole thing last night. And if you follow the link to Caitlin Johnstone's piece, there is a link at the end of hers to the full letter from Bill Arkin. Check it out if you have the opportunity. Dr. Jeffrey Kay is a retired psychologist who's become quite a journalist. And back on December 16th, he made a report at Medium that has been largely overlooked. I haven't seen any coverage picking this up. What he has learned is that there were actually two torture programs run by the Central Intelligence Agency starting in early 2002. It was the Renditions Program that had its own torture element, and the Enhanced Interrogation Program. This is new information that this kind of bifurcation has never been defined previously. And Jeff Kay is working on a second installment of this story, and when that's complete, he's agreed to do an in-depth interview, so we'll cover it in more detail at that time. Hasan Minhaj used to be on The Daily Show. He's now got a series that's on Netflix, and it's called Patriot Act. And he is a very funny guy. His second episode has been removed from Netflix subscribers' access in Saudi Arabia because he made jokes about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And Minhaj has tweeted, "Well, clearly the best way to stop people from watching something is to ban it, make it trend online, and then leave it up on YouTube." So Netflix, is not making it available on their platform, but it is on YouTube, and it is viewable in Saudi Arabia. So I think this is interesting, and I would just encourage people to follow the money. There's a lot of Saudi money invested in tech companies here in Silicon Valley. And I didn't do a deep dive, but Netflix has partnered with the Japanese entity SoftBank to fund its expansion into new markets. SoftBank receives a great deal of investment from the Saudi investment fund. And finally today, while we're talking about Saudi Arabia, The New York Times reported during the holiday break that the largest contingent of on-the-ground fighters in the Saudi war in Yemen is made up of mercenaries from Sudan. They are called the Rapid Support Forces, and we used to know them as the Janjaweed Militia. They were accused of systematic rape of women and girls, indiscriminate killing, and other war crimes during the conflict in Darfur. And they are so desperate that they are fighting for pay in Yemen. And get this, to keep a safe distance from their battle lines, the Saudi or Emirati overseers who command these Sudanese fighters do it exclusively by remote control. It's amazing. When you've got unlimited funds, you can do all kinds of things. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. I remain Peter B. Collins. Oh, and you can find this on YouTube, even in Saudi Arabia.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.